Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. We are here today to talk about PM Press. And I have a very special guest to talk about PM Press. Why don't you, Ramsey, go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Ramsey, Ramsey Canaan, and I am one of the co-founders of PM Press.
All right. So let's start with, can you tell us what, I mean, first, let me just say, I have the main way you get find guests for podcasts is via books that are coming out. I mean, there's just this book podcast ecosystem, and I haven't ever tallied it up, but I think it's got to be that the most common press that provides a guest for this podcast has got to be PM Press. Certainly, when I interviewed Ruth Kenna about her book, Anarchic Agreements, I mean, that's a PM Press book. I've had so many PM Press authors. So if you're listening to this podcast and you don't know what PM Press is, let me tell you, you do know what PM Press is. Maybe I didn't say the press name. Ramsey, why don't you tell us what PM Press is?
Well, I mean, PM Press is a publisher of fantastic literature. I guess some of your listeners might be somewhat familiar with. We, the founders and current, you know, folks involved with PM Press, and there are now, I think, 18 of us full time. You know, we all come out of various aspects of anarchism and left Marxism and other forms of anti-authoritarian theory and practice, shall we say, as well as some of the attendant subcultural or cultural roots, particularly punk rock in our case. But you know, we have the, I don't know, old fashioned yet perhaps simple premise that we think that ideas actually matter, and we're doing our damnedest to help disseminate those ideas, I guess, as our modest contribution to creating a better world for the rest of us.
Yeah, I think this idea that ideas matter is a good one. It's certainly one that I believe. I mean, I was chatting with a friend about this podcast, and he said essentially it's a philosophy podcast. And I wouldn't call it a philosophy podcast. I didn't mean to start a philosophy podcast, but it really is. What I am interested in is the ideas, and I have found just this incredibly rich tradition of ideas in anarchism. And again, a ton of them have come to me via PM Press. Now, I should say, while we're here, I am not terribly familiar with your career, but one of the few things that I do know is that you were also a co-founder, is that right, of AK Press?
I mean, I was the founder, I guess.
You were the founder of AK Press. And so when I first started studying anarchism, I went for a lot of these big anthologies, and a lot of them, it seems like, came through AK Press, like the Kropotkin Reader edited by Ian MacKay, or No Gods, No Masters, which I believe is a French author, but was, you know, published in this really good edition by AK Press.
Yeah, Daniel Garin was the editor of that anthology, yeah.
But I will say this doesn't mean to be a criticism of AK Press. I've liked a number of their books over recent years. I certainly have gravitated in stuff that's been published over the past decade or so. I've found PM Press to be more exciting and interesting. Do you want to talk about why PM Press exists as opposed to AK Press? Again, this is not a story that I know well. I don't know how controversial or complicated it is either.
I mean, in one sense, it's not controversial or complicated. I mean, I, as a young kid, you know, by the time I was 13, I had discovered both punk rock and anarchism. This would have been in 1979 when I was 13. And, you know, what led me to both of those by the age of 13, by 1979, I guess would be, I mean, I guess an interest or, well, to me, they were both kind of intertwined. So I was attracted to both for similar reasons, I guess. I was brought up in a household full of books, and my mother in particular always suggested, was always suggesting books for me to read. And she would kind of try and shape my already existing passions by offering me better iterations or better versions of that. So as a kid, perhaps like many young boys, I was completely obsessed with war and would read widely and indiscriminately on war. So everything from, you know, biographies of Hannibal of Carthage's military campaigns to, I don't know, whatever, histories of, you know, Waffen SS, panzer divisions in the Second World War, and kind of everything in between. So my mother, you know, would both encourage my reading in general by dragging me off to the local library. In fact, I was a member of two or three different libraries in the small town where I grew up, as well as, you know, taking me off to yard sales and that kind of thing. And so always plying me with literature, but also, while my parents were not political, I say they were big readers, and so I grew up in a household full of books. So my mum would say, you know, you're in a war, why don't you read Catch 22 by Joseph Heller? Why don't you read, she'd give me All Quiet on the Western Front by Erich Remarque. So, you know, by the time I was 13, I'd already read widely, not just on war, but I'd also read a lot of the kind of classics of literature, I guess, you know, your George Orwell and your Alexander Solzhenitsyn and whatever. And I'm guessing it's through reading that I decided I was an anarchist, I guess. And then once I decided I was an anarchist, I then started reading books on anarchism, if that makes sense. At the same time, as I say, I got into punk rock in the late 70s. And then also kind of dived headfirst into that kind of underground, so-called DIY punk rock subculture, you know, the world of fanzines and putting on shows and that kind of thing. I played in two or three bands, the only one that lasted for about 10 years, maybe a wee bit longer. And we produced lots of records and toured the world and that kind of thing. And so to me, as I say, the kind of my interests, I was following my passions and my interests, those being kind of words and music, I suppose. But secondly, in terms of my, for want of a term of, I don't know, for putting those ideas into practice, shall we say, or taking them beyond the armchair, it was through the kind of so-called anarcho-punk underground. This would be in the UK in the late 70s, early 80s. As an active participant in that subculture. And then through that subculture and through my interest in politics and activism, discovering more formal strains of anarchism. So I started distributing fanzines and other kind of underground literature at a very early age. So again, you know, age 13, 14, whatever. And then by doing that and through my activism, my politics, I came in contact with other anarchist literature. I think the first actually anarchist newspaper I bought was in 1979. It was on a CND march, CND being the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which was the main kind of anti-nuclear, both weapons and nuclear power, I guess, organization in the UK at the time. And, you know, I bought my first anarchist paper. Is called Extra, X-T-R-A, exclamation mark. And I bought it at this demonstration, this march, partly because obviously by then I decided I was an anarchist, and secondly because I was already by then a punk rocker, and the paper was being sold by these other punk rockers on the march. So again, I kind of gravitated towards them. So as I say, it was that kind of symbiotic process of me discovering politics and then kind of plunging headfirst into both the musical and the political sides of that activism, I guess. And I guess I've been doing the same ever since. You could perhaps accurately assert that I'm actually tediously one-dimensional. And I've done the same thing all of my life for the last, you know, whatever, more than 45 years at this point.
So how did you go from this punk rocker to the founder of AK Press then?
Well, I said I was already distributing, I was already disseminating ideas, albeit perhaps badly written or half-baked ideas in the form of fanzines. And again, and then as I, there was a big squat gig in London. This rock club called The Zigzag was squatted. I think it was in 1981, but maybe it was 1982. I was down in London. I was actually en route to the Middle East to visit my family. Because I was already a participant in this punk rock and political milieu, this underground, I heard of this gig for some reason. And so I turned up at this squat gig. And because I was already distributing stuff, I turned up with my plastic bag full of fanzines and was harassing these innocent concert goers. So I say this is a big, it's one of the kind of legendary events in British anarcho-punk. So anyone who is everyone kind of played at that. So Crass played, Poison Girls, Conflict, Zounds, The Mob, a bunch of smaller bands. So, you know, it was a kind of a who's who of the kind of anarcho-punk scene kind of played there. And there wasn't that many people there. I'm guessing there was a couple of hundred people there. Again, I was one partly by chance and partly because the punk underground wasn't that huge in some ways. But anyway, I was there peddling my wares and I noticed there was this bunch of what I thought were really old dudes with beards, big beards, sitting at the back of the table. And despite their hirsuteness, they were sitting in front of a massive table of literature. And my, whatever I was, 14 or 15-year-old self thought, this is the way to do it. You know, they're not harassing people. People are coming to them. Plus, they have a massive spread because they have a whole table's worth of literature. So I went up to them and said, who are you? What are you doing? How do you do it? And it transpires that they were from a radical bookstore called Houseman's in London in King's Cross, which is actually still there today. And they were friends with Crass and, you know, they'd been invited to come and sell books and other literature. So I then discovered Houseman's, the bookstore. And after that, every school holiday, you know, every Christmas and Easter and summer, I went down to London, which I'd already been doing, and started hanging out at Houseman's. And they were very tolerant and of this annoying little kid, pestering them with 1,001 questions. And they basically mentored me and showed me how it ought to be done, much to my delight, as well as being a fantastic bookstore, a radical bookstore, all kinds of literature. They were also involved in distribution and involved in publishing. So they literally kind of showed me how to do these things properly, or certainly to move beyond the ways that I was doing it. So I say this carried on. So the first publications that I published as AK Press were kind of co-publications with various folks that were involved in Houseman's. And they, you know, they were the first people to give me radical literature for me to then redistribute. You know, as a distributor, they could sell to me and I would be able to sell it on to other folks, etc. So again, and this happened throughout the 80s. I was also, so the band I was in got, was, you know, fairly large underground, or, you know, part of this underground punk, anarcho-punk world. So again, I would sell literature at our gigs. I would, you know, I was starting to publish stuff. I was starting to distribute literature to other bookstores and record stores and all that. At a certain point, so this is all just doing it all myself. At a certain point, I was involved with probably the biggest political struggle I was involved with was called the anti-poll tax movement in Britain, which was a kind of 3 or 4 year campaign that we waged. Mass movement. What a terrible thing. A massive mass movement. It was a really big mass movement. In fact, arguably the biggest mass movement ever in certainly British history and perhaps in world history, in that we got 50% of the adult population of the UK never paid this law. That's a different story. Anyway, so I was actively involved in that struggle over the course of many years. At a certain point, there was a chance to open this radical bookstore in Edinburgh, where I was then living. I moved to Edinburgh in Scotland in 1990, 1984, maybe, when I was 17, when I left high school. There was a chance to start this radical bookstore, and the folks other than myself that were involved in this failed attempt were comrades of mine from the anti-poll tax movement. And when the bookstore never got off the ground, these other three people said, well, we'd still like to be involved in radical literature and the distribution of ideas. At that point, it stopped being just me, and I set up AK as a workers' cooperative. This was, again, still in, so that was maybe in the year 1989 or 1990, maybe. Then in 94, I moved to America and set up AK Press in America. And then in, fast forward that to 2007, myself and two other folks, I guess it'd be accurate to say we were the minority faction within AK Press. and I should stress that the difference was not really political. It wasn't because we thought the rest of them were a bunch of liberals or vice versa. It was more over kind of stupid personal stuff, or perhaps not stupid personal stuff, or more accurately, it was probably over the form and the practice of how to work cooperatively rather than over the politics, over the end result as such. Anyway, so I think AK Press was 11 people at the time. So I say there were three of us that were kind of the minority faction. And so in 2007, we formed PM Press. That's a super accelerated potted history there.
Yes, no, I mean, that gets us where we need to go. And this brings me to, you know, one of the questions I've had. I mean, so when you mention anarchism to anyone, at least anyone who is not an anarchist, or even plenty of people who are interested in anarchism or call themselves anarchists, there's the question of, like, how would it actually work? And I've actually been wondering, as someone on the outside of places like PM Press, how do you run an organization on anarchist principles? And I'll just a brief example. So there's this famous American activist named Jane Addams. She didn't claim to be an anarchist, but she's a Tolstoyan, which is in my mind a branch of anarchism. And she runs this famous organization called the Hull House Settlement. And she goes to Tolstoy and meets him. It's this great pilgrimage. And he says, you know, well, what do you do for work? And she says, oh, well, I just, I live off my income, and I just put all my time into organizing the settlement. And he says, well, first of all, you're a landlord, so you're an oppressor because you're living off of capital. And secondly, you're an oppressor of the people you're working with because you're doing all the organizing and you're not doing any of the actual hard work. And Jane Addams comes home and has a crisis and tries to do less of the leadership, and it doesn't work. And she ends up having to take on the paperwork, and she just sort of has to make peace with being the paperwork person. And this is the kind of thing that people say, like, oh, well, you can't have anarchism because someone has to be the paperwork person. To me, that doesn't mean anarchism doesn't work. But I am curious about how PM Press works, and how you sort out these sort of the sort of problems faced by someone like Jane Addams when she's confronted with this mythic anarchism that Tolstoy has, or in his head. Tolstoy himself is a landlord and all of these things. And what happens when you try and put these principles into place in a world where it can never be perfectly the way you would want it to be?
So I think you're, if I may make so bold, you're actually talking about two different things which are related.
I agree. As I was going through that, I was like, wait, there's two things.
How could anarchism work in general? And so there's an argument, a very persuasive argument in my mind, made by folks like, say, the great anarchist writer and thinker Colin Ward. He wrote many, many books on all kinds of things, and he was his day job was as an architect and as a designer, town planner, an urbanist. Anyway, perhaps his most famous book is called Anarchy in Action. And in that book, Colin Ward, his basic thesis is that the world only exists, the world exists, that society only functions basically because in many large and small ways we're already living in an anarchist society, and that the most important thing we can do is continue living in those cooperative and ways which are, you know, full of mutual aid and cooperation, and then get rid of this external sets of authority and hierarchy, which are, of course, are what is steering the world kind of incorrectly. And so, I mean, he gives all kinds of examples from, small scale, but, you know, most childcare is done on an anarchist fashion. It's done on a reciprocal basis, and you're helping out your family members or your neighbors because that's just what one does. You're not doing it because to make a profit. You're not doing it because it's a classic example of mutual aid. And then he takes it kind of to the international level, that the way that you can until Trump kind of fucked it all up. But until, you know, you can post a letter basically anywhere in the world, and as long as it's not an active war zone, it will be delivered. Why is that? Because all the different postal unions in every country of the world have all come to a mutually acceptable agreement that they'll deliver each other's mail. There's no coercion involved. So again, I say from the super complicated, sophisticated ways of organizing to the kind of to the micro. So in one sense, taking that, if you take those principles, the challenge has always been not so much how do we organize in certain ways, but how do we organize in certain ways which are more or less in tune with our principles and with our politics, and how do we self-organize in that sense, but also how do we continue to exist under capitalism? Because the very existence of capitalism and the way capitalism is organized is completely inimical to this. Now, I don't mean in terms of certain forms of organization. I mean, in the early 21st century, lots of business has adopted more horizontal ways of organizing. During COVID, for example, everyone was actually forced, most people, to work from home in many, many jobs, where previously they'd been come into an office where they were a centralized, non-centralized location, but where the managers could be literally and figuratively looking over one shoulder and ensuring that. So again, COVID proved that actually people, and hence society, and in this case capitalism, can function quite well without those centralized forms of control and of organizations, and without those direct hierarchical, that actually productivity didn't plummet when you didn't have a series of managers and overseers and four foremen and four women and four persons, kind of, again, you know, those layers of bureaucracy on top of the worker. And of course, post-COVID, now the managerial class want everyone to go back to working so they can be more correctly overseen. But I say, be that as it may, the tension that we have is how do we both survive under capitalism? Because in the case of PM Press, we have no other source of income other than by selling stuff. Now, obviously, we think that the products, so to speak, that we produce have more social use value than, say, many others that are produced, and perhaps less than some others which are produced. But either way, we think that we're contributing, again, we hope, to that better world. Nevertheless, unless we shift units, we're not going to be able to pay our rent, we're not going to be able to pay our wages, you know. So there's that contradiction or that tension or that series of tensions of how do we actually. So that's one thing. Or to put it another way, we have to be really good capitalists to survive under capitalism, because otherwise we won't survive, let alone thrive, so to speak. Secondly is how do we actually build lasting institutions which can actually pose, be part of that infrastructure, be part of that fabric, be a contributor to the ability to actually overcome, supersede, and destroy, ideally, both capital and the state, and then continue to build something more equitable and more just in its place. And I say continue to build because I think very few people think that revolution is the Big Bang Theory revolution, that, you know, we have a revolution and the next day we wake up and things are cool. All of these things are obviously processes, right? So it's always a work. And nevertheless, in the process that we'll try and supersede, overcome, move beyond, destroy, whatever epithets we want to apply to it, to successfully take on capital in the state and hopefully, as I say, to win those struggles, means there's a series of processes. As I said earlier, you know, we're trying to contribute to, we're one small piece of that larger picture, or we're one small tributary or one small stream that's feeding into that wider river of, you know, revolution and change. But to do so, to be able to challenge capital in the state effectively, in our humble opinion, we actually need to have building, we need to build institutions. We need to build institutions that would mean that so people can come across and can access these ideas. I mean, for me, you know, literature in the grand sense of the term, reading Camus and, as I say, George Orwell was my entryway to more radical politics or radical ideas. For other people, somewhat including myself, it was punk rock. But people need something, right? They need that entry, they need that doorway, that entryway to access, to stumble across, to interact and engage with these radical ideas. And so what I've attempted to do all of my life is to provide those you know, that way of accessing ideas. And again, I should say that there's actually two things involved in that. One is the production of ideas. And I think, you know, without any false modesty, once you know what you're doing and are willing to do it and are willing to spend the time and the money and the effort to do it, it's not that difficult. Meaning publishing it's not that difficult if you know what you're doing and you're willing to spend the time and the money and the effort, right? So again, I don't think I've produced at this point, I've published, I don't know, several thousand books because I'm a sort of genius or it's just because I say it's largely because I'm a boring one-track mind and that's all I've done all my life. And I've learned how to do it better and better, et cetera, et cetera. So in one sense, the production of good stuff is easy. The challenge is always the dissemination, right? How do we actually get it out into the world? Again, I've spent many decades of my life literally sleeping on boxes of books. That was my platform bed. So, you know, to me, the tricky thing, the challenge has always been the dissemination of ideas, not the production of ideas. Because again, if they're not disseminated and people don't interact with them, then who cares? So how do you provide that vehicle or that institution that's going to create and disseminate those ideas? But then secondly, which is, I think, is a long way of coming back to your initial question, within that institution, how do you build an institution which is trying to act in as many ways as one can or as we can in those ways which are simpatico with our, you know, the way the world we want to see down the road, so to speak. So as the old cliche is, we're you know, what are the Zapatistas or whoever they say, we build the road as we travel. You know, we make the road by walking on that road. So, you know, how do we organize internally? Well, again, there's lots of cliched ways you can do it, which we do. Everyone is paid the same. Everyone has decision-making power insofar as it affects their job. So the way we are currently organized within PM Press is that all the different aspects of our work has what we call a working group. So there's a warehouse working group. You know, we have a bookstore in Ithaca. So there's a bookstore working group. There's a production working group. There's an editorial working group. There's a sales and marketing working group. There's an events working group. There's a financial working group. So all these different working groups are composed of different folks within, you know, the 18 of us, insofar as, I mean, there's not everyone that's a member of every working group. Of course not. You spend your entire life in meetings and not doing anything actual work. But so, you know, those working groups kind of make decisions that are pertinent to those. If you submit a book to PM Press, the editorial working group is going to be the folks that are going to say yay or nay and will help, you know, get it contracted and all that kind of stuff. It will then move on to the production working group, which will involve the editing and the copy editing and the design and the layout and all that. And then that book, as it goes further down, will then be involved in the sales and marketing working group and then the warehouse working. So I'm saying, so it's a series of concentric overlapping circles based on that horizontal model, I guess. That's how we take the decisions. I mean, are these things perfect? Of course not. And, you know, one person, one vote, whether it's in a small group or a larger group, is not in itself democratic. I mean, these are the kind of things that we struggled with in the AK days. If there are X amount of people and it's one person, one vote, how do you weight, for example, interest? How do you weight knowledge? Should someone that hasn't read the manuscript be able to vote on whether one should publish that manuscript? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe their vote should count for less. You know, and you know what I'm saying? So these are all imperfect systems, but these are all systems that we're trying to make work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. And that's a fantastic answer. And it's an answer that I think is not going to satisfy people who think that anarchism has to mean, you know, no meetings and no organization. And there's people who consider themselves anarchists who have that definition as well. But that's
that's, I mean, so as someone that thinks that ideas matter, I actually think anarchism actually matters. But also, you know, my definition of anarchism, there's lots of people who call themselves that. One of the problems with anarchism is that it more or less accepts anyone into its ranks who calls themselves an anarchist. I think that's a load of bollocks. I think anarchism has to mean something or it's meaningless, right? If we say that anarchism doesn't mean chaos, anarchism doesn't mean do what you want whenever you want, we're already defining it, right?
Yeah.
Or we're actually already, you know.
No, I completely agree. And I think to a certain extent, this is a response to Marxism and Trotskyism, which have strict doctrines. And so I think historically the anarchists have not wanted to have strict doctrines, and that, which is good. I'm in favor of not having strict doctrines, but that can also lead to something so amorphous that it's hard to
It really depends what your doctrine is. I mean, actually, I think, as I say, I come from the tradition of what we called in the UK class struggle anarchism. And my definition of anarchism is basically the self-determination of the working class. That's the kind of one sentence one. And that's because if you accept that we live under capitalism, then you accept that we live in a class society. If one accepts or one believes that change is going to come because those that need change most are going to be the ones that actually make that change, then by definition, again, you're talking about the working class. So to me, that's self-evident. But that already puts me at odds with lots of other definitions of anarchism. And again, I don't care. I mean, I don't care because I'm right and you're wrong, but I don't care because, to me, the most important thing is that ideas matter. Ideas, as you were suggesting, are not immutable. They're not fixed. Ideas, like the rest of our lives, are messy and complicated and are subject to change. You know, the world is changing around us, and to have that same set of ideas be immutable and, you know, they're not applicable necessarily in whatever our great theorists were, it doesn't mean that their words still ring as true today as they did 100 years ago or 10 years ago for that matter. Similarly, I'm not wedded to what has popularly been known as anarchism. I mean, you know, I said earlier that we draw on various anti-authoritarian or left Marxist traditions. I mean, I've already said that I believe that we live under capitalism, hence I believe in the Marxist definition of, you know, of class society and blah, blah, blah. You know, I think anarchism is weak in many areas, and historically and usefully, you know, other traditions have been much richer, particularly in economics, but also in talking about the importance of culture. Anarchism has been great in that it's been fed into by a couple of particular subcultures, but in terms of analyzing what does that mean, and, you know, what's the weird relationship between subculture and actual politics and political change? I mean, these are thorny issues. So anyway, you know.
Yeah, no, that's great. I agree. They're thorny issues. Let's stop there, except to say that I know that PM Press is doing a big fundraiser right now. So can you take a moment to tell us about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've struggled all my life to try and build viable institutions. And, you know, I was very lucky that I came across some viable institutions which have had a big, big influence on me. The first one, of course, being Housman's Bookstore. The reason the Housman's Bookstore is still there today, meaning whatever, 45 years after I discovered it, is because it's owned by the Quakers, and the Quakers bought their building. Similarly, as a kid and as an adult, both in the UK and in America, a lot of the places where one would go to meetings are often either owned by the Quakers or by the old Communist Party. Now, again, I have 5 million problems with the Communist Party, but the Communist Party was good at building institutions. It was good at building not just that gateway drug to how people could discover politics, but then also how do those politics are nurtured, how are they moved forward. And again, in their case, they actually bought buildings. So again, what we as PM are trying to do, and what I've been struggling with all my life, is how do we build these viable institutions? Not only institutions that will, I mean, literally be there in that brick and mortar sense, but institutions that don't crumble when the great leader or the founder or the whoever is no longer involved. I mean, again, whatever problems I may have had with AK Press and vice versa, I think it's fair to say that the way that AK Press was set up meant AK Press is still going. So again, I think it could be fairly argued I set up an institution that actually has continued despite its founder, you know, buggering off and doing something else. So again, so that to me is the challenge. And I think for better or for worse, again, in living under capital as we do, that is the literal brick and mortar aspect of it, which is as important as the other internal stuff. So again, we're trying to do both. In the case of the current fundraiser, we did financially very well out of COVID, meaning we looked good enough on paper that the bank was finally, for the first and only time in our lives, no longer, we were able to get a mortgage, and we actually bought our warehouse in upstate New York in Binghamton. We've paid off about half of that mortgage in the first 4 years. But the only mortgage we were able to get was this mortgage that basically every 5 years, it's a 30-year mortgage, but it's only fixed in those five-year increments. So our mortgage comes up at the end of, well, I guess in January 2027, the mortgage rate is going to go up again. And given the current state of the economy, it's going to go up precipitously. So our plan is to try and pay off the rest of the warehouse. Again, the bigger goal is actually to create some more permanent institution for, you know, the dissemination of ideas. And a place where people can also interact with those ideas. So, yeah, we're doing a fundraiser at the moment to try and buy the warehouse if we don't meet our goal, which is a lofty goal, 250, quarter of a million, obviously raising X amount is better than none. So, you know, it all helps in terms of that institution building.
All right. We will have to leave it at that. Ramsey, thank you so much. And best of luck with becoming a freeholder, I believe is the old term. Owning your own land. That sounds great.
Yeah, we would like to prize away from the bank, certainly.
Yes, that's the goal. All right.
To become really free. All right, fantastic. Thank you very much, Graham.
All right.
Appreciate
Bye
it.
Now.
Thank you.